Hello, and welcome to the Skeleton Factory Podcast.
Episode 62.
This is Adam coming to you from Austin, Texas. And it is just after 1 o'clock a.m. here in Austin, Texas. It's been a kind of gloomy, rainy week here. We've had rain, we've had thunder, we've had some beautiful lightning here. Don't get this type of lightning and thunder out in California. You know, it's actually very beautiful here. And I got a really nice double feature for you. It goes great with a rainy day. So let's jump right into the movies, shall we? The first film is a 2022 film called Sick of Myself, directed by Christopher Borgli. A young Norwegian couple is finishing up dinner at, no doubt, a very fancy restaurant. Birthday dessert arrives at the table along with a $2,300 bottle of wine. How lovely. But things are not what they seem. The couple plans to run out on the bill and steal the expensive bottle of wine. Mr. Boyfriend, the character of Thomas, instructs Miss Girlfriend, character of Signe, to pretend to take a phone call and walk outside. Signe agrees if Thomas would tell their friends at a party that it was Signe that stole the pricey bottle of wine. So after the restaurant, they have a party they plan to go to, and she wants to make it very clear to the party guests that she was the rebel thief that took the expensive bottle of wine from the restaurant. We cut to the street outside, where we see Thomas being chased by a waiter. Thomas manages to get away. The waiter starts to walk back to the restaurant, walking right past Signe. Doesn't even notice her, which she seems almost offended by. So later, at the party, Thomas is sharing the wine with his close friends. He's very braggadocious in telling his friends how he alone stole the wine. Meanwhile, Signe stands in the distance looking angered and betrayed. This scene sets up the dynamics between Signe and Thomas. He is a kleptomaniac. He's also an artist who makes sculptures out of stolen chairs and ottomans that he steals from stores, hotel lobbies, etc. Signe works at a cafe, and she has no interests, really. She has no hobbies and is very openly jealous and resentful of Thomas's up-and-coming art career. She's desperate for attention and recognition, even if it's negative or self-destructive attention. She sabotages a dinner party speech Thomas is giving after a career-launching art show. She fakes a nut allergy and plays it up the more the dinner guests inquire about her non-existent condition, going as far as to collapse during Thomas's speech at the dinner. It's hard to say if Thomas is clueless to what she's doing or if he's just the sweetest and forgiving boyfriend ever. Signe comes across an online article about a skin disease linked to a Russian pharmaceutical drug called Ledexol, The article shows horrifying images of purple, textured, open sores and veiny skin lesions on the face and body of users of Ledexol. After this, she scores some Ledexol from her drug dealer, Stian. We get a montage of her frequently taking high doses of the drug, and lo and behold, she starts to develop deep bruise-like skin rashes, first on her arm and face. After overdosing on the drug, she becomes hospitalized. The movie then begins to go into her innermost thoughts, delusions, fantasies about how this already bad situation can become worse than it is. This isn't her fear. It's actually her hope. The worse, the better. Any attention is good attention, even if it's pity. But make no mistake, Sick of Myself is a comedy. And the movie doesn't let Signe's spiral into insanity go without some laughs at her expense. But that's the point. Signe would welcome hogging the spotlight even if it kills her. If you're a longtime listener of Skeleton Factory, then you know I'm a sucker for movies about characters that are a danger to themselves and those around them, especially in clean, modern environments. And I would refer you specifically to episode 52, titled Modern Dutch Fantasy and Sci-Fi. In that episode, I discussed the films Borgman and NR10 from director Alexander Van Warmerdam. Those two films are good examples of what I'm talking about. Seemingly perfect, affluent people whose spotless existence gets turned upside down and dragged to the dirt. Signe eventually finds a way to exploit herself. The condition from the drug begins to horribly disfigure her face, and she exploits it in a way where she wants to not just get the attention of people around her, but to get media attention. She even gets a modeling job as an atypical looking model for a clothing company. Her face is permanently scarred, looking almost like someone threw acid in her face or a burn victim. There's a scene where Signe meets with the head of the modeling agency who wants to sign her. They explain how the agency wants to be inclusive by signing models with deformities. The head of the agency even has an assistant who's blind. And at one point, while they're having their conversation at this big conference table, the assistant attempts to get Signe a glass of water, but has trouble finding the water jug and the glasses. She's blind after all, and she's walking with the white cane with the red tip. So even finding, once she actually gets the glass of water, even finding where Signe is sitting is an unnecessary challenge. It's like, Signe, just get up and get your own damn water. Or the lady from the modeling agency, it's like, why don't you just go get Signe a glass of water? Why are you letting this blind woman run around and do errands for you? She can't see where she's going. But she wants to be inclusive. That's the whole point. And that's the movie makes it a point to sort of make that a joke. But, you know, it's funny to watch a blind woman stumble around while no one helps. So the plot intensifies the more attention and pity she receives, the more her health declines and her delusions of grandeur start to bleed into reality, where even us as spectators, we don't know if what we're watching is a fantasy or if it's actually reality. So, do I recommend Sick of Myself? Yes, I do. It's a very good movie. I have never seen any of the work of Christopher Borgli, but I very much look forward to seeing some more of his work. He did a film before Sick of Myself called Drib, and I'd really like to see that. I've only seen the trailer for it, and from what I can gather, it's a movie about, I guess it's based on a true story, I think. But it's basically about this guy who faked sort of viral online videos of him. I don't know if he's fighting or being attacked by people on the street or provoking people to beat him up or something. I know Harmony Korine actually was shot a movie that was like that. It's literally a movie about him starting fights with people on the street. But as you can imagine, that's not a sustainable film to make if you're getting your ass kicked constantly. So, but the movie Drib is about this guy who fakes online viral videos of him getting in physical altercations and basically conning a well-known international energy drink company to have him be like a spokesperson. And in the trailer, they mentioned that they cannot say the name of the company because they will be sued. So instead of making a documentary, they made a film. And I guess the actual guy who made the original videos and actually tricked the energy drink company to bring him on as a spokesperson, I think he plays the main character in the movie, if that makes sense. But yeah, it's called Drib, and I haven't seen it, but it is on my movies to watch list, so I will watch that as soon as possible, and I will report back as soon as possible. But in the meantime, you can go check out Sick of Myself. It is, let's see, it's put out by the company Utopia that puts out some really good stuff. I would suggest looking at their, looking at that, that movie company. They're doing a lot of really good new stuff. And yeah, check out Sick of Myself. It's brand new. It's streaming. It's pretty easy to find. And I definitely recommend it. It's sort of, it's one of those movies. I can't recall which episode it was, but I know I reviewed recently a film called Ingrid Goes West. And it's basically about a woman who becomes obsessed with people on Instagram and begins stalking them and trying to sort of insert herself into these people's lives, like trick them into, you know, becoming her friend. She's basically a crazy person, and she causes havoc in, I believe, one of the Olsen sisters. It's the other Olsen sister. You know, the one that's not a twin. I believe she's the star of it. And at the end, she tries to kill herself on, I think, Instagram Live. And then the videos go viral, and then she ends up getting all the followers and the attention that she wanted over doing some crazy nonsense. And she doesn't learn a fucking thing at the end. You know, I don't know. Sick of Myself is like a better version of that kind of premise for a film. Ingrid Goes West is very, I don't know, it's very sort of Southern California, lame and goofy, just self-absorbed people who are just not really that interesting. And, but the premise of somebody becoming obsessed with you know, somebody on the internet and then actually starting to stalk that person in real life and actually worming their way into that person's life is, you know, just on paper is very interesting. But I think Sick of Myself is a better example of somebody who just wants recognition but has no real talent and has really nothing going for them besides their sort of narcissistic urge to be loved by strangers. Yeah. Also, Sick of Myself is one of those movies that has a very good quality to it. And that quality is, every once in a while I'll watch a movie, and as soon as I'm done watching it, I need to watch that again, because I feel like there's a bunch of stuff I missed. And the upside of having a show where you review movies is a lot of times I'll watch a movie twice, sometimes three times, but I watched Sick of Myself twice. I watched it once just to sort of absorb it, and then I watched it a second time so I can write notes. And the second time, it's like you pick up all these little things, all these kind of little setups and payoffs, all the little foreshadowing things that were sort of sprinkled around the movie. That, you know, it's great. Everything ties together nicely. Everything makes sense. And even when the movie sort of like slips into Signe's delusions and her fantasy world in her head, the movie makes it very clear that that's a fantasy and it's disconnected from reality. Even though the fantasies seem real. So, yes, Sick of Myself. Definitely recommend it. Go out and watch it. Watch it with friends. Watch it alone at home with your dog or cat or goldfish or iguana or ferret or bird, whatever, whatever animals you have in your house. It's fine. But yes, you know, before I get to the next movie, I'm going to take a hit of some wine here. Ooh. That is nice. I was actually going to review two other films on top of the two that I'm doing on this episode. I was going to do a total of four. And the other two were actually part of the same series. But I decided to not review them. And I was going to review two films. The first was called The Third Saturday in October, Part 1. The second movie is called The Third Saturday in October, Part 5. Now, The reason why there's a part one and a part five is because there is no part two, three, or four. Okay? It jumps from one to five, which sounds weird, but I get the filmmaker's logic behind it. So the first film, The Third Saturday in October, sets up sort of the world, the rules, the mythology of that particular horror film. It's basically a slasher film. And it's modeled after movies like Halloween and The Town That Dreaded Sundown. And pretty much any movie where there's like a boogeyman out there in a mask killing people, you know. I don't know. Take your pick. Madman. Movies like that. What else? I don't know. My Bloody Valentine. Movies like that. But that's giving this movie too much credit. Those movies are great. And a third Saturday in October is... It definitely has some positives. It's the way it's shot. It looks like, I believe it's supposed to be in like 1979, I think. And it looks like it could have been shot in 1979. I mean, I can tell it wasn't, but, you know, historically it gets sort of that era right, you know, everyone's cars, the buildings, people's furniture in their house, their old TVs they're watching, you know, the old diner in town, everyone's clothes, all those sorts of things, like, feel good. They feel right. But I just, I don't know, I will say I did like one more than five, even though I've, you know, from what I've read online, people seem to like five more than one, but I don't know. But it's basically about this town where I guess he would be considered a serial killer. This sort of mass murdering serial killer guy. He's going to be executed. And only two people show up to view the execution. He's being executed in this comical electric chair in the town, and the guy gets executed, but he doesn't die, but they think he's dead. They put him in a casket and they drive him down to the cemetery to bury him in an unmarked grave, I guess. But he comes back alive and he kills all the cops that escorted his casket to the cemetery. And really the story follows the two people that were there who've lost loved ones to this killer, follows them to they follow the casket to the cemetery to, you know, watch it be put in the ground. But by the time they get there, like, the casket's open, cops are dead, you know. So basically the killer comes back to life and he goes on a killing spree. And, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, he's got kind of his whole getup is fine. He's in a suit, which was weird. People don't get executed in suits. Like, when they executed him in a suit and then threw his body into a casket. You know, I thought that was really weird. He's wearing a mask. The mask he's wearing is fine, I guess. I mean, he's not wearing one the whole movie or anything like that, but, you know, and he finds a bunch of teenagers who are smoking weed and having premarital sex and yada, yada, yada. And he starts picking them off one at a time. And, you know, it's a pretty standard slasher film formula. And the movie was just excessively long. Like, you probably could have cut out a good 20 minutes of the fucking thing, really. It just really needed to be tightened up. But, you know, I thought the movie was okay, but then I immediately watched The Third Saturday in October Part 5, and it's supposed to take place in the 90s, and it, for the most part, gets the 90s right. It looks like the 90s, and it's definitely shot different. It doesn't have that sort of artificial film grain look to it, like... people more or less look like they're from the 90s. I don't think it's too far off, but, and I don't know, the beginnings, it seemed like it was off to an okay start, but I don't know. Here's what happened. I got a full night's sleep. Okay. I watched the first movie. Like, as soon as I woke up, I'm already pounding coffee. I start drinking coffee the second I start waking. I wake up, and then I watch the second movie. And I got like 20 minutes into the second movie. I'm probably two and a half cups of coffee deep, and I fucking fell asleep watching the movie because I got really bored. So that's basically my unofficial review of the third Saturday in October, part 1 and 5. But I don't know. I didn't find it necessary to include it on the show, really. But maybe I'll change my mind about it. Maybe I'll go back and watch it, and maybe there's something I missed. I don't know. But, you know, maybe there's a scenario where I do a deep dive on the third Saturday of October franchise. But it's not going to be today, and it's not going to be on this episode. So, but I'm glad. I'm glad. I'm not doing 4 movies on this episode. I'm going to just be doing 2 because there is nothing like a strong double feature, you know, especially on a rainy week like we've been having here in Austin. Just a nice, solid double feature is great. And, oh boy, the second film, we're going to jump straight into 80s action movie territory right now. And this one is great. It's Shakedown from 1988, directed by James Glickenhaus. And it's starring Sam Elliott as Detective Richie Marks and Peter Weller playing New York public defender Roland Dalton. Okay, so we have we have Sam Elliott and Peter Weller in a buddy cop movie. Already, we're off to a good start. We open in the late 80s when crack was the fentanyl of the day. It's nighttime in Central Park, and there's a black dude drug dealer who's smoking crack, blasting music from his boombox, or ghetto blaster, as they were called back in the day. You know, just minding his own business in Central Park when a white dude in a head-to-toe Canadian tuxedo appears. That if you don't know what that means he was wearing jeans and a jean jacket. That's what that really means. So he's wearing a Canadian tuxedo, and he appears out of the dark and asks to buy some crack from Mr. Crack Dealer. And the white dude asks if the black drug dealer can turn off his boombox. And drug dealer's like, yeah, man, sure, I can turn it off. The white dude's like, I don't like rap music. Can you turn that off? Because I want it to be quiet while we're having our drug deal in the dark, I guess. So, but the drug dealer, he sensed that something is off with this dude. So instead of stopping the tape, well, he stops it and then hits record. Okay. So from this point, we cut away to a random cop car. And if you can hear it through the radio, through the dispatch, it says it's a car 54. I'm like, oh, ha, ha, ha. If you're not familiar with, if you're not up on your Nick at Night reruns or your MeTV reruns, Car 54, Where Are You? Was the name of a comedy cop show from back in the old black and white TV days. So dispatch calls Car 54, and they go and respond to a shooting in Central Park. So we cut back to the park, and police have descended on the scene. So both dudes are now on the ground. The white dude is shot dead. The black dude is shot, but he's still alive. So we don't really know what happened between the two of them. So this is a solid opening that sets up the story to unfold. And then from here we go on to meet Roland Dalton, played by Peter Weller. and Peter Weller, you'll know as RoboCop. He was hot off of RoboCop. He did RoboCop, and then he did this movie. So Roland Dalton, he is in the process of leaving behind a long, grueling career as a public defender in New York to take on, I guess, a lawyer-type job at a Wall Street insurance company or law firm, something like that, ran by the father of Roland's fiance. So his soon-to-be father-in-law, he's going to go to work for in a legal capacity. So he's taking the upwardly mobile route, because I guess being a public defender in New York in the 80s, I can't imagine was too much fun. As opposed to now, where it's probably really easy. People get arrested, and then you get them released the next day, regardless of their crime. But Roland has one final case to do before he can, you know, close the door on his, you know, on his public defending career. Is one final case, and that is defending the surviving drug dealer from the Central Park shooting. And his name is Michael Jones, the character, but I'm just going to call him Mike Jones. So he has to defend Mike Jones for the murder of the white man in blue jeans who happened to be a police officer. Mike Jones gets arrested, goes to jail. He was shot, but he was just wounded. He wasn't, like, you know, in danger of losing his life, really. But Mike Jones is in jail, and I believe he's at, I think he's in Rikers Island, and Roland shows up as his public defender, and Mike Jones tells him that O'Leary, the cop, didn't identify himself as a cop and, in fact, tried to rob him and shot him first. But what jury would believe an admitted drug dealer killed some guy he didn't know was a cop in self-defense? That's quite the problem that Roland has. So Roland is going to need some help, some serious help with this particular case. So, enter Detective Richie Marks, played by the always perfectly grizzled Sam Elliott. They're clearly longtime friends, but Richie is apprehensive about giving out too much information to Roland, but tells Roland that O'Leary may be a dirty cop that robs drug dealers and keeps the profits for himself. And this type of cop that does this is what's known as a blue jean cop. Which actually everywhere else in the world that carried this movie, everywhere else it was distributed to, the movie was called Blue Jean Cop. Blue Jean Cop, or probably Blue Jeans Cop. Yeah, that's what I meant to say. Blue Jeans Cop, but in America it was called Shakedown. So Richie warns him that the people that Mike Jones works for are not to be fucked with. And Roland tells him he doesn't want to fuck him. He just wants to dance. Oh, yeah. Peter Weller's, he's brave in this movie. And so now our buddy action film is starting to take shape. We have Roland and Richie. Their chemistry is awesome. Roland is the sort of lawyer who's used to dealing with scumbags, but at the same time, if a scumbag is going to be prosecuted for a crime he didn't commit. Roland can't allow that. Okay. That scumbag needs to get proper legal representation because, you know, he has ethics, he has morals. You know, he's kind of a Boy Scout in that regard. So let's look at what we have. We have RoboCop and Wade Garrett from Roadhouse teaming up to fight drug kingpins and corrupt cops in 80s New York. I love it already. So, it becomes obvious to Richie once he starts kind of digging into things, and Roland starts digging into things and they start kind of collaborating, that it becomes obvious that the other cops in the narcotics division, same division that Richie is in, it's becoming very clear that the other narcotics division cops are dirty, including the departed Patrick O'Leary. And we get a scene where Roland goes to Patrick O'Leary's house to visit his widow to kind of snoop around. He got in the door kind of through false pretenses. He was like, "Oh, hi, I'm a lawyer and I'm you know, part of the legal team that's investigating your husband's murder, yada yada yada. Like, may I come in?" sort of thing. But really, he was sent there by Richie to snoop around to see if there was anything unusual about Officer O'Leary's house. And in fact, there was. He ended up finding a custom-made red Porsche under a tarp in Mr. O'Leary's garage. Now, this will become important later. But already he's like, custom-made Porsche on a cop's salary. That's very suspicious. So after busting the nightclub of a drug kingpin, Nicky Carr, played by Antonio Fargas, who you'll know as, you may remember him as Fly Guy from I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. He was the guy who had like, aquarium. He had like a goldfish aquarium like built into his platform shoes. If you remember I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. He's also in the movie The Borrower, the Ray Dong Chong movie, directed by John McNaughton, and I cover that film in a Patreon episode titled October Means Spooky Movies. And that is on the Skeleton Factory Patreon at patreon.com/Skeleton Factory. You can go there and listen to it for free. And while you're there, you can become a patron and support the show if you like. I would prefer that you do, and I would appreciate it very much. It helps a great deal on the show. So Richie and Roland discover that the dirty cops on the force, specifically the character of Officer Wydell, who's sort of the leader of the dirty narcotics officers. He's sort of the main narcotics kind of undercover. He's kind of like the main dude. But he's also the kind of the taskmaster, the guy who's kind of like concocting all the kind of all the illegal stuff that's going on. And everyone else just sort of just falls in line. So the dirty cops, led by Officer Wydell, are working, we find out, with Nicky Carr, the drug lord whose club got busted. And they end up making a deal with each other. And the deal is the dirty cops will make all of the collective evidence against Nicky Carr disappear. And the collective evidence was basically, there was a scene where Sam Elliott, who's one of the narcotics cops, and all the other narcotics cops, they go to Nikki Carr's club. They break in. It's a bust. They go into Nikki Carr's office where they find, oh my God, it was something like over $100,000 in cash and 7 pounds of cocaine. So all that got seized by the cops. And it's like sitting in a storage locker. So the deal that Nikki Carr made with Officer Wydell was, look, I'll make all that evidence from the bus disappear. And in exchange, Officer Wydell wants Nikki Carr to kill Richie, Sam Elliott. Okay, so now they're really in cahoots with each other. So now Roland and Richie definitely can't trust any of the police, and there's this drug lord who's coming after them. Okay, so we have all this going on, and this weaves together on Roland's side of the story. So if you recall, Roland, he is defending Mike Jones, and Mike Jones recorded the dirty cop, Patrick O'Leary. He recorded him attempting to rob and kill him in cold blood. So he has evidence on tape from his ghetto blaster. Now, that cassette recording, if discovered, could exonerate Mike Jones, as well as lead a trail to Officer Rydell and the other dirty cops and bring them down. But at the moment, his boombox with that tape inside of it is just in the same storage locker, that sort of evidence locker, at the police station, and they don't know that that recording is actually on it. That was just, the boombox was like Mike Jones' sort of personal effects. Okay, so they don't know that that tape contains that recording. But in an attempt to steal this recording from the police evidence locker, Roland ends up getting caught trying to do this by Rydell and the dirty cops. And they attempt to destroy the tape and kill Roland. But Sam Elliott kicks in the door and kills two of the bad cops with his comically humongous non-regulated cop pistol. And so Wydell, he manages to get away before Sam Elliott shows up and like kills everybody. But I just got to talk about Sam Elliott's gun for a second. There's like a scene where Sam Elliott's in the police locker room and he's like sitting on a bench and he's cleaning this huge gun. And Rydell has a locker conveniently next to where Sam Elliott's sitting. And he's like, he goes over to his gun. He's like, wow, that doesn't look like police issue. And Sam Elliott's just sitting there cleaning this huge fucking gun. And Rydell goes over and picks over one of the rounds from his pistol. And he's like, 45 Magnum. And it's this huge fucking gun. And okay, so according to the Internet Movie Firearms Database, okay, and this, it's a real website, it's imfdb.org. Richie Marx's gun from Shakedown was a LAR Grizzly Mark One, and Richie Marx's pistol was a 45 Magnum. So huge, awesome, amazing looking gun, and it's a perfect weapon for all of your buddy cop action film needs. In fact, Sylvester Stallone, his gun in Tango and Cash is also an LAR Grizzly Mark One. And apparently there's only like, I don't know, there's something like less than 1,500 of these things exist in the world. They stopped making them. But from everything I've seen, apparently they fire really well. They're incredibly well made. But just the size of the thing is quite intimidating. It's, I mean, the only two things you can really use the thing for is sort of big game hunting. But from what I can tell, a lot of big game hunting with a handgun would usually fall into a very high caliber revolver, but I guess the Mark One is a sort of a pistol alternative. So if you need to go shoot a fucking an elephant or something, I guess that is the gun you use. But okay, so Roland gets caught by the bad cops and they're about to kill him. Okay, and then Richie breaks in, bam, bam, kills two of the bad cops. Okay, Wydell is already out of the building. He managed to get away early. And Roland is like, I need to get back to court because he's still doing the whole murder case for Mike Jones. So Roland grabs what's left of the tape that Wydell tried to destroy, scrambles a taxi, and races off across town to court to present the tape recording as evidence. But when he gets there, the judge tells him that she couldn't let it be entered into evidence this late into the trial. So Roland is forced to give his closing argument. So we get a great scene of Peter Weller giving his closing argument, okay? It's just one long, unbroken take, by the way. It's over 2 minutes long. And this movie actually kind of manages to sneak in some good courtroom drama into this, like action film, which I thought was really, really great. And there are a couple of scenes that are like fairly long, just one long take type of scenes. And I really liked that. I really appreciated it. It gives the pace and adds some variety to the pacing of the movie. So after closing arguments, Mike Jones is found not guilty. So, you know, good for Mike Jones. Roland was able to do some good lawyering and get an innocent man out of a murder one beef. So that's pretty cool. And but then after this, Roland needs to hurry out of court. So he like says goodbye to Mike Jones. He's like, I'll see you in jail, because he knows that Mike Jones is still a drug dealer and he's still a criminal and he's just going to end up in jail again anyways. So he's like, yeah, I'll see you in jail. So Roland runs out of the court, where he's met outside by Richie, who's driving that bright red custom Porsche that was in O'Leary's garage from earlier. And they speed off to the airport, where Richie finds out that Rydell and Nikki Carr are about to board a private jet and fly out of the country to Costa Rica, because at this point the jig is up. So they're both heading to Costa Rica, you know, where all bad guys and, you know, movie gangsters go to hide out. And as the jet is taking off, Richie and Roland drive onto the runway and catch up to the plane. They drive right up underneath the plane, and Richie's obvious stunt double in a wig jumps from the Porsche onto the landing gear of the plane, and the plane takes off. And we get this hilariously awkward sort of matte shot of Sam Elliott sitting on the wheel of the plane. And he shoots out the hydraulic system underneath underneath the plane, then shoots out one of the engines of the plane, forcing the plane to have to circle back to the runway before they crash into the World Trade Center, basically. And that happens in the movie, and it's really awkward. You know, they're like, okay, so Richie shoots out the hydraulic system, you know, in the cockpit, stuff starts beeping, and they're like, oh, what was that? And then he shoots out one of the engines, and the pilots are like, oh, we got to go land. There's something wrong with the plane. But you can tell that the plane is kind of like kind of swerving from side to side. And when you, the shot looking out of the pilot's, you know, windshield, you just see like the World Trade Center towers. So they avoid hitting the World Trade Center towers. Then Richie throws a hand grenade into the undercarriage of the plane and then jumps off of the plane into the Hudson River just in time for the plane to land and then explode, killing Rydell, killing Nikki Carr, and two innocent pilots that did nothing wrong, basically. So Sam Elliott just murdered two pilots. Oh, well. But, okay, so Richie lands in the water. He manages to swim back to shore into the waiting arms of Roland. Now, the movie should have just ended there. You see the plane in the distance. It's just a ball of fire, okay? And our two heroes were able to, you know, save Mike Jones from going to prison for the rest of his life. And they were able to take out Nikki Carr, you know, the big drug lord boss guy, and Officer Wydell, who was sort of the ringleader of all these dirty cops who were, you know, doing illegal stuff. So yeah, that's where the movie should have ended, but that's not where it ended. We end up getting a whole wrap up to Roland's. So the movie basically had like a B plot that was running this whole time during this action movie that I didn't even mention, but I'll mention it now. So the movie decides to wrap up Roland's B plot. At some point, Roland starts having sexual relations with the assistant district attorney, who happens to be prosecuting the Mike Jones case. Mm. And him, the district attorney lady, they have a lecherous past, okay? They, I guess, used to be a couple, and it was very hot and heavy and everything, but they ended up breaking up, you know. But they still had the hots for each other, sort of thing. And once this case got dropped, in Roland's lap, you know, they sort of started kind of flirting. And then next thing you know, they're, you know, fucking at her apartment, you know. So now Roland is, he's engaged the whole movie, okay? He's engaged. And even though he's cheating on his fiance, the movie convinces you that the fiance is like stupid and annoying and sort of deserves to be cheated on by giving her unlikable character traits. Like what, Adam? Well, unlikable character traits such as she fakes getting pregnant for no reason other than to kind of mind fuck Roland into staying with her, even though Roland is in the middle of this crazy murder investigation where people are trying to kill him, trying to kill his friend Richie, and he's trying to get an innocent man from going to prison for the rest of his life. So she, you know, It's like faking a pregnancy in the middle of all of this. It's not cool. Also, the movie makes a point to point out that she has no idea who Jimi Hendrix is. And not only does she not know who Jimi Hendrix is, but she does not know that Jimi Hendrix isn't a heavy metal band. There's a scene in the beginning of the film where Peter Weller is making his breakfast, which consisted of popcorn and homemade Orange Julius. It's not really Orange Julius. It's just milk, orange juice, and instant coffee and raw eggs. That's his... I guess that's how Peter Weller maintained his skeletal-like physique all through the 80s. But he's making his breakfast, right? And he's listening to Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child. And she, like, she comes into the kitchen while he's jamming out to Voodoo Child. And she just, like, turns off the music. Doesn't turn it down, just turns it off. And is like, good morning, what are you doing? How annoying is that? That's like if you got into your car and somebody just turned off the music you were listening to. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that's cool. You know, I turn into Samuel L. Jackson and Foxy Brown. You know, people get in my car, I'm like, hey, man, don't mess with my levels. I got them just where I like them, you know? So... And then Peter Weller has to go to the extent of telling her, like, okay, Jimi Hendrix is not a heavy metal band, babe. Okay, just so you know. So that kind of just, I don't know. And it seems silly, but, you know, just her sort of ignorance of that makes her unlikable somehow. Also, same scene, before she leaves, she insults Peter Weller's tie that... The movie makes a point that Peter Weller points out. He's like, I like this tie. It's a tie he likes very much. And not only does she say she not like it, instead of saying she doesn't like it, she made that sort of like imitating someone about to puke by sticking a finger down their throat. She's like, oh yeah, your tie, by the way. Ugh. How rude. Can you be, miss? How rude can you be? Also, I think, and it's probably the worst thing that she did was at one point, you know, Roland is like super deep into this investigation. He's sitting at his desk at home and she's basically like, she expresses that she does not care. If Mike Jones gets wrongfully sent to prison for a murder that was probably self-defense, you know, because to her, she says something to the effect of, well, you know, Mike Jones is just a criminal anyways who sells drug to kids. Who cares if he goes to prison for murder? Like, what difference does it make? And, you know, Peter Weller sort of, you know, it's a good scene where he can reinforce. He's like, who cares? I care. He's like, I know that Mike Jones is not, you know, he's no angel by any stretch. Like, the man's a criminal. But this case is a clear case of self-defense. Like, someone was trying to take his life and he defended himself. So the movie's also very pro-gun, by the way. So if you're a big fan of stand your ground laws, I mean, I know I am. I live in Texas. So, but yeah, she's just like, who gives a shit? He can take the rap for that cop's murder. Who cares if he's innocent? He's a criminal piece of shit anyways. He was going to go to prison one way or another anyhow. It's like, do you really want to marry this woman, Roland? So the movie goes to the extent to make you not like her. So when Roland inevitably ends up cheating on her, you don't really, I don't know, you don't care. So also, Roland ends up leaving his fiance at the very end. I mean, they totally threw this in at the last possible minute. He's at like a dinner table with his fiance's family, and he's basically like, okay, I'm leaving you, and I'm not going to take the big job on Wall Street at your father's company. I'm just going to continue to be a public defender because that's what I'm good at, and that, whether if I want to admit it or not, is what I love to do, and I'm going to go back to fucking my ex-girlfriend. And the movie really kind of makes it seem like, oh, that's fine. Why not? And that's the end. That is the end of Shakedown. And I love this movie. It's great. I highly recommend it. If you love 80s action films, and there's a lot of cheesy, bad, kind of, you know, 80s action films that are, you know, they're good because they're kind of corny, and, you know, sort of, you know, some of them, like the stuff that makes them bad also makes them good. But this movie is good. Okay. It's like Lethal Weapon good. And that's high praise, I think. At your earliest convenience, go see Shakedown from 1988. It's awesome. You'll love it. It's a great double feature with Sick of Myself. Okay, there you go. What else can I say about Shakedown? It has a lot of character actors in it, sort of, you know, actors that are like, you know, that guy. When you're watching a movie and you're like, hey, it's that guy, you know, some kind of random actors in a scene, and you recognize their face, but you don't know their name, but you've seen them in a bunch of stuff. The whole movie is just littered with dudes like that. Like, for instance, Officer Rydell was in one episode of Miami Vice from season 2 titled Little Miss Dangerous. And I love that episode because the Little Miss Dangerous episode is the episode where the bad guy for that, you know, particular story was Ted Nugent, 80s Ted Nugent. And and if you've been listening to this show, you know, you know, for any amount of time, you know that I love the 80s television show Miami Vice. And I will bring it up whenever I can. Miami Vice and Ted Nugent in the same episode. Pretty amazing. Also, there's a song, I think it's called Little Miss Dangerous. It's a Ted Nugent song, and it's very 80s. And it's in the show. It's awesome. It's so good. Who else is like that guy? Here you go. If you listen to episode 61, you'll recognize the name of a guy named Rockets Red Glare, who he had a small part in Shakedown. He was he was like the front desk guy at this like seedy 42nd Street brothel. There's like a scene in like this brothel, and he's like the dude at the front desk. And he was in Oliver Stone's talk radio that I cover on my Eric Bogosian episode, which you can go back through the archives and listen to that. It's a great episode. But he's the killer. He's the guy who kills, spoilers, he's the guy who kills Eric Bogosian's character at the end of talk radio. And he was also in Mystery Train, which I covered in episode 61, the Jim Jarmusch film. He's, you know, I think he's a regular. He's like a regular in a lot of Jim Jarmusch films, but he's another one of those guys. You see him, you're like, hey, it's that guy. Speaking of talk radio, John C. McGinley, if that name sounds familiar, who's he's in Shakedown. He's like Peter Weller's sort of lawyer bestie. Like, they're friends, and they have a, there's a whole scene where they're having lunch, and John C. McGinley is, he's been in everything. He was in talk radio. He was like Eric Bogosian's like producer in talk radio, and he was in Platoon. He was in Point Break. He was even in Office Space. He was one of the Bobs. If you remember, they were doing work evaluations in Office Space, and these two guys, both named Bob, were kind of deciding who's going to get laid off and who isn't. He's one of the Bobs. He's been in a bunch of other stuff too. He was also in the show Scrubs, but I think Scrubs is stupid. So, but who else is in this? Vondi Curtis Hall. He was in Mystery Train with Rocket's Red Glare. Vondi Curtis Hall, he was in Mystery Train. He was like Joe Strummer's friend, Ed. He was like his drinking buddy at the bar. Let's see. You may know him better from the film Falling Down. He's the guy who's holding up the big sign that says not economically viable, and then the police come and arrest him. He's the not economically viable guy. Who else? Oh, there's the scene where Roland gets captured by the bad police and they're gonna kill him, but then Sam Elliott comes in and saves him. Okay, well, Peter Weller runs out of the police station, he jumps in a cab, and he, you know, speeds off to the courthouse. The cab driver who gets him to the courthouse, the cab driver is played by an actor named Tom Martirosian, and you may remember him as the character of Agamemnon Bousmalis from the TV show Oz. If you watched HBO in the 90s, you'll know the show Oz. He was Agamemnon Bousmalis, also known as the Mole. He was like the old dude who had a really fashionable bucket hat. There was like, at some point, there was like two old dudes in Oz, and I guess he got sent to Oz because he was like a professional, like he knew how to break into highly protected vaults, like bank vaults, but he would do it by digging tunnels under and into the vaults. But yeah, he's the cab driver who gets Roland to the courthouse on time. He's also, here you go, we got another Miami Vice connection here. Tom Martirosian plays FBI agent McIntyre in season one of Miami Vice in an episode called No Exit. And he's also in season three in an episode titled Streetwise, playing a completely different character. So, yes, the Miami Vice connections are aplenty. And also, oh my God, just keeps going with actors that are that guy. I know that guy. Who is that guy? I know that guy. Okay, there's the actor Holt McColony. I think I'm saying his name right. Holt McColony plays he kind of plays like a random cop in this movie, but I mean, you know, he's not like in the background, like the camera, he's like, you know, he basically gets a close up in this movie, but he plays some like random cop in Shakedown, but you'll know him as Bill Tench from Mindhunter. He's like one of the main characters of Mindhunter. He's sporting an excellent flat top. If you haven't seen Mindhunter, I recommend it. It's a very good show. It's a David Fincher show. It's wonderful. He was also in Fight Club. He was like the mechanic guy. I think he's the same guy who's like, in Project Mayhem, we have no names, but in death, we do have names. His name was Robert Paulson. I think he's that guy. Let's see. But yeah, I love shit like that. If you didn't have that guy, then, you know, Rob Zombie wouldn't have a career. He's made a career off of casting people who are that guy or that lady. So, and stuff like that just really tickles me. What else does this movie have? Well, this movie, if you love the aesthetic of the old 42nd Street New York grindhouses, Shakedown has tons of it. And whole action scenes on 42nd Street, which was at the time still like dangerous and sketchy to do. Apparently they had to have like a lot of security and like personal bodyguards for Peter Weller and Sam Elliott, because yeah, it was still dangerous back in those days. Even though Shakedown was shot sort of in the tail end of that era, it was still 42nd Street at the time. So, but yeah, if you love that sort of, you know, the big old theaters in the bright marquee lights, peep show neon signs, you know, like the New York of like Taxi Driver, you know, or Basket Case, or Abel Ferrara's Fear City, I love that. This movie is just, it's got a whole bunch of that. I mean, when we first see Sam Elliott in Shakedown, he's asleep in a theater on 42nd Street. And he's in a theater that's playing the 1982 movie The Soldier. And basically after that scene, him and Peter Weller comes and meets up with him, and they both like walk out through the lobby and onto the street, and they walk past the sort of the, you know, the hallway movie posters, the one sheets of The Soldier and the movie The Exterminator from 1980. And both of those movies were directed by James Glickenhaus, the director of Shakedown. So that's cool. And actually, in the same scene, which is another scene that kind of, you know, it's not like the longest scene ever. It's not like the scene where they're, you know, walking through the kitchen into the club and like Goodfellas or anything like that. But it's still a good scene where they're walking through the theater out into the street. And once they get outside the theater, we see a marquee in the theater next door to the one that they're in that's playing, they're playing A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors, and The Hidden, the Kyle MacLachlan movie. And The Hidden, here you go, The Hidden co-stars Richard Brooks, who plays the character of Mike Jones in Shakedown. And it's funny, because in The Hidden, he plays a cop. He's Officer Sanchez, and he ends up getting shot. So, but, you know, The Hidden was the year before Shakedown in 1987. So James Glickenhaus, he had a strong run, mostly as a producer in the late 80s, early 90s. He produced Maniac Cop. He did Basket Cases 2 and 3. He produced, and he produced Frankenhooker. Tremendous career. But yeah, I think in the future I'm gonna go try to dig up some more good cult just ridiculous cop renegade action films, because this one was great, and I would like to find some more that are of a similar, you know, caliber. A couple come to mind, but you know, we'll see what happens. I have one in mind that actually would be amazing, but we'll get there when we get there, okay? Well, I think this was a pretty good show. I think that's a pretty solid double feature for you to sink your teeth into. Go check out Sick of Myself. It's streaming right now, and so is Shakedown. Well, if you all need to get a hold of me, if you have any movie suggestions for me, or if you need some personalized movie suggestions or recommendations from myself, feel free to give me a holler over at Instagram at skeleton_factory. You can also follow me on Twitter at SFPodcastATX. And if you'd like to support the show, please, please consider supporting the show at patreon.com/skeletonfactory. There's a bunch more free audio episodes there. And every little bit helps, and it's greatly appreciated. So that is the end of my plugs. Well, I'm going to probably go have one more glass of wine, and then I'm going to go to bed because I am going to go see comedian Doug Stanhope tomorrow, and he's playing here in Austin at noon for some reason. I've never been to a comedy show for a comedian of that caliber at noon. I don't know. It strikes me as weird that Doug Stanhope would even be awake at noon, but I guess that's what I'm going to be doing tomorrow. So, this is the Skeleton Factory Podcast, rescuing your movie night one movie at a time. I have been your host, Adam. I will catch you all in the next one. Bye-bye.